And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. You're now listening to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you do lose that sense of humour, you will go friggin' nuts. Now, coping mechanisms, these are something that I was talking about earlier in terms of theorising that the truth movement in general is suffering from a form of post-traumatic stress disorder. When dealing with any trauma, there are many, many coping techniques that people will often undertake. Some of them are inherently healthy, others are inherently damaging to your health, right? Now, I feel that laughter in the face of scumbaggery, much like Doctor Who, is a good thing. It's a good, healthy response. Just like the reason why somebody can accuse another radio host or something of that nature of working for the Mossad, and that person will suddenly crack up laughing, "I work for the Mossad!" Perfect response, because there's nothing you can actually argue against somebody accusing you of something that's not true.
Right.
That they can't prove.
Proving a negative, yeah.
Just to laugh at them, because it's just so insane. Mark Passio is my very special guest. What on earth is happening? .com is the website. And as I mentioned when I introduced you in the first segment, some of your research, and I just want to thank you for your articulate nature, because I believe that both myself and tens of thousands of others would not actually be wise to many, many concepts that are currently affecting our lives if not for your ability to explain it in a way that we can comprehend it, Mark. And I just want to thank you on behalf of these tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people out there that have actually had their lives and their ability to think literally changed by your taking personal responsibility for categorizing and explaining clearly and unemotionally these topics, which are so important to humanity today. Thank you.
Well, I respectfully will accept that as a high compliment. I want to thank you and tell you that I appreciate that. I do feel that's one of my strong points is my communications capabilities and being able to explain some seemingly complex and possibly non-interrelated topics and bringing them together in a framework or a tapestry through which they can make much more sense to people. As very, very connected, inextricably connected, and needing to be seen as such if we're really going to understand what's going on in the world all around us. So that's something, you know, I do take pride in that capability. I feel like it's definitely a forte of mine. And that's what I really said from day one that I was going to be trying to do when I stepped into this field, is really paint the tapestry in people's minds. That's why I tell people it's so important. You can't hear one of the interviews that I do in isolation. You can't listen in for 5 minutes on a YouTube video or, you know, check out a video that I've done with another radio show host and just say, well, I know everything that this guy's talking about. You really need to take my advice and go to my webpage and check out the podcast in progression, in sequence. I think many people who have done that have probably gleaned and the most and benefited the most from that tapestry, because that's where it is slowly unfurled. And you get to see all the different aspects of it. And if you do it at your own pace, and at your own leisure, when you have time to, and you know, you move through it without skipping ahead and do it in progression, it's very deliberately laid out as in a specific sequential order, such that other worldview starts to open up and the big picture really makes sense. So that was definitely deliberately designed as such, and I'm glad to hear you say that you feel that it came across very effectively.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like using an inverted Freemasonry model, where instead of occulting the knowledge and then making people pass certain levels before they can get access to the other knowledge, you give people all access to the knowledge so that they can accumulate it for themselves, not to open them up to a level of being corruptible or open for demon possession, as some people have theorized, but indeed to open you up to your own spiritual awareness, your own
potential. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and that's why I like to call myself a de-occultist. You know, people will say, well, I'm an occultist. I study the occult, and you know, I learn these teachings and, you know, live by some of these teachings. But I don't like to even call myself an occultist. I prefer the term de-occultist, which means taking things out of hiding and distributing them widely and freely, such as to attempt to level the playing field, because the playing field is not level when there is a differential in knowledge, when one group has a tremendous amount of knowledge and they're holding it over people's heads. You know, that creates a tremendous power differential. So if we're going to level the power differential and bring it to balance, we have to level the knowledge differential by distributing knowledge openly and freely. And that's what I've attempted to do with my website and all the information that I put out.
Can I give a New Zealand example? Because you're talking about knowledge. And when I think about knowledge and one culture having more knowledge than another, I think about technological advancements that allow that other person to enslave that other culture. You come in with muskets and you're up against bows and arrows, you're going to kill everybody who's got a bow and arrow pretty easily, right?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
And just think about this. That's the level of technology. I mean, comparatively speaking, what the general public has access to in terms of weaponry for the purposes of self-defense versus what the establishment armies have access to is far out of kilter.
Sure.
That's a really dangerous position, because what we're talking about here is, and I think somebody mentioned this to me last night, Mark, and I want to get your opinion on it.
Sure.
We're merely slaves on the plantation, right?
Right.
This is it. And I wanted to, you know, grab my megaphone and just go out to a crowd and everything like that and speak to them and I go, friends, countrymen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome.
Right.
Thank you for being here. I would love to referred to as a slave of the plantation. It'd be great.
It's sad but true. And, you know, that's really what I – whenever people who don't really know what I do or what I'm into and they ask, well, what's your website about, I no longer try to say, hey, it's about consciousness and all of its aspects and understanding how consciousness works. It's about, you know, how we are creating the reality that we're experiencing through our thoughts, emotions, and actions. You know, how, you know, there's a police state all around us and many people can't see it. And, you know, I don't even get into or tell them, oh, I teach occultism and symbolism and astrotheology. I don't even get into it, trying to explain all these different aspects of what I talk about. What I tell people that I do, or what I tell people that my website is about, is I simply say it's about slavery and how to end it once and for all. And I just say I'm completely against all slavery in all of its forms. And what the information on the site is trying to do is show you that we're in the current human condition is a state of slavery. And the website and myself advocate for the end of that condition, which is an immoral condition for humanity to continue to exist in. So that's what I tell people that what I do is about. I am an anti-slavery activist. You could call me a de-occultist who tries to take hidden knowledge, which is what the occult is, and bring it to people in open capacity, in an open source type of format. That's one label I would accept willingly as a de-occultist. But I also like to refer to myself as an anti-slavery activist, and I think that's what people really need to unify on. What we're really trying to do in the truth movement and the freedom community is end slavery once and for all on planet Earth.
Now, it's interesting you should say that, because it occurred to me, I've been to hundreds of protests, Mark, on all sorts of topics. The one signs that I don't see are signs that have the words slavery on them. Nobody's protesting slavery because they don't even realize that they're slaves.
That they're in it, yeah.
Because the knowledge of your slavery has been occulted, all right?
Right.
So,
right.
Hence, if we're talking about human race, okay, and versus, and maybe it's dualistic, maybe it's not, the human race, the free human race, with all our potential, all our beauty, all of our intricacies, then over here we have, let's say, an inhuman entity. Whether they're actually human and they just act like real douchebags, or they're off some kind of off planet scumbaggery. Who cares? Point is, the effect of them doing what they're doing to us, the free human race, is the same in any language, and the same in any universe. Therefore, there has to be a universal resistance. And I think that this concept that you've touched upon here, indeed, may be the key, is simply recognizing, not fearing, not feeling defeated by, but just recognizing the simple, obvious fact that we're not actually free. We are currently slaves. We have slave masters who at any point they wish they can mess our life up real good and real fast and real heavy.
So, yeah, many different aspects were brought up here. The very enormous differential, not only in the knowledge that a lot of the slave masters, if you will, the people who are currently in control of this planet, hold over the ignorant masses of humanity, you know, and that's because, again, the knowledge of the occult is twofold. When you say that, again, it brings up a lot of connotations in people's minds. Many people still don't know what the word occult means. I gave a presentation here in Philadelphia last night, locally, and I asked people how many people were expecting to hear about the occult or knew about what the occult really is, and like 90% of people raised their hand. Now, obviously, they were coming to hear me speak, so they probably knew about my work previously, of course, so that's a skewed number. But it's really good to see that this word is starting to be really understood more and more by people, and the negative connotations are being released and let go of, and people are really understanding what it truly means. It means hidden. That's all. Occult comes from the Latin adjective occultus, and that in turn comes from the Latin verb occultare. Occultus means hidden, and occultare means to hide or to conceal or to keep secret, to keep away from someone's sight so that they're not able to see it or understand it. That's all the occult is. It's hidden knowledge. Now, what constitutes that body of knowledge? Well, there's two aspects of occult knowledge. The first is called the minor or lesser knowledge, not to mean it's any less important, but it is the knowledge of the microcosm, the small things, or in other words, the individuated units of consciousness, meaning the people. It's the knowledge about how a human being works, or any real being. It's knowledge about how thought within an individuated consciousness in the form of a being like you or me works, okay? So if we understand those aspects of consciousness, we're studying the psyche. We are studying the soul within the individual. We're studying the personality. We're studying what drives them, what makes them tick, their fears, their inhibitions, you know, their desires, etc. That's psychology. By any other name you want to call it, it's the study of the psyche. Okay, so that's what's called the lesser of these two forms of knowledge. Then there's greater knowledge, or what has been termed in occult schools of thought, the knowledge of the macrocosm. The knowledge of the macrocosm is how the universal laws of nature function and work, and how they actually interoperate with our free will decisions and our behaviors to help to bring the results of how we behave to us, so that we have to experience that and learn from it and grow as a result of making those behavioral decisions. That's the knowledge that I've called natural law. So it's the knowledge of psychology combined with the knowledge of natural law. Now think about how powerful just those two bodies of knowledge is, how empowering those two bodies of knowledge, if they are understood, become.
So I know how the world works, and I know how people think. Like, not just being arrogant about it, but actually knowing, that is such a powerful individual. You know, that's like almost godlike power.
You know, I wouldn't liken it to godlike power, because I would say that's the ability to make those laws. But you could say in the absence of that knowledge, one could be seen like a god, if someone were so ignorant that they had never undertaken any aspect of any of those studies and knew none of it. imagine the differential in power. It would seem like down here you would have this little lesser being, and up here you would have this godlike being that knew everything about how everything works. Mm. When in fact, this is just simple science and simple understanding of how fundamental systems work, Yes,
and this analogy also goes back to that the ancient astronaut theories and what have you. If theoretically some race did come to Earth long ago in spaceships and whatnot, wouldn't they be the gods from the heavens?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because this is exactly what my talk in Philadelphia was about last night. I really came forward and talked about a lot of things. I don't know if I want to start to unpack this here today in this interview. I'd like to keep it toward the occult side of things and the psychological side of things. But
indulge me.
I'll give you a little teaser. The video will be online soon. It will be on my website and YouTube channel. It was recorded. It was recorded from multiple angles. We're going to try to do some nice video editing and get the slides in there and everything and put out a nice video. But I did get into this very hypothesis theory, if you will, or I call it simply an explanatory synthesis, that if we did have interactions with off-world beings that was very traumatic in our past, this could very much explain and account for many aspects of the current human conditions, and also explain why we have certain institutions in place the way that they're in place in the modern world. That's what my talk last night was actually about. It was given as I was invited by a fellow researcher in the Philadelphia area, Chris Augustine. He runs a local group here in Philadelphia. It's called the Philadelphia UFO Meetup Group. And he invited me to speak, and he said, is there any topic you really want to talk about that maybe you've been tight-lipped about in the past or have been reluctant to talk about because you haven't unpacked all of the other information you wanted to get to before, in other words, preparing the way and leading up to talking about, a topic that you people may be skeptical about hearing about, but if you pave the way enough, then maybe now is the right time. And I said, yeah, there is a lot of stuff that I'm going to start talking about and covering in that field, and I feel that the time is now to do that. So last night was probably, I laid it all out on the table in the presentation that I gave here in Philadelphia, and that will be available soon. But it touches on this very concept that you were talking about. If we look at a differential in knowledge, as I believe it was Arthur C. Clarke who once said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from the supernatural or from magic. Okay, a being with lesser amount of knowledge regarding technology or regarding how the universal laws of nature work would see another being who had that knowledge in their possession and was able to wield it seemingly at their will, okay, as a god. And I do feel that is more likely than not what did occur in our ancient past when we had interactions with beings that are not indigenous to the Earth, or what you would call simply extraterrestrial.
May I provide an even more modern example? I think it was even in 1962, I believe, a couple of researchers and explorers in Papua New Guinea found a lost tribe there. It had never been touched by civilizations in tens of thousands of years. And they showed them a lighter, and everybody in the whole village was like, whoa, you can make fire, like that. And they're like, yeah, you just wait until tomorrow when our seaplane arrives, you're going to really see something then. So he gathers all the villagers and everything the next day out by the beach to see the seaplane coming in, expecting them to be totally shocked, like wow, it's amazing. And the seaplane comes in and the villagers are like, so what? And he goes, well, what do you mean? And the explorer says, what do you mean?
Fire.
What do you mean? So what? And they say, well, of course you can fly. You can make fire come out of your thumb.
Right. And it's kind of like a parallel to the cargo cults also around the World War II era. These tribes that had never seen planes fly, they venerated airplanes and the beings that flew them and almost took them on as like gods because they had never seen technology such as that before. And that's really what we're talking about as the current human condition. There's been these people who have had the knowledge of hell, these two interrelated bodies of knowledge work. The one being how the psyche works, how the human mind works, and the other being how the laws of nature work. And if you combine those two areas of knowledge and you sequester it as much as possible from the bulk of the human population, and again, sequestering it, deliberately hiding it, deliberately holding it back, that's one way of keeping it occulted, okay, or hidden. Another is to simply dissuade people from looking into it verbally, you know, or put a group of people that you call the mainstream media in and just never talk about it and say, well, that's just fringe and we think that there's nothing to that, or only crazy people ever look into stuff like that. And therefore, you know, that you are dissuaded from ever going there. You know, it's like you don't even have to be held back from it. You just ridicule people for going there, and most people willfully say, I want no part of that knowledge because that's seen as the lunatic fringe. Yeah. It's a very clever manipulatory tactic psychologically to make people stay away from information which they need more than anything else in life in order to better their condition, and they will shun it willfully if only you provide that ridicule factor for them, and they'll just fall right in line and say, there's nothing to see here.
Now, we still exist in a wish to be dominated position, rather wish to be led. Okay, people aren't used to the idea of,
yes,
everybody's their own leader. Everybody has personal,
right,
responsibility. Everybody has personal power. Nobody can tell me what to do. No, but I can't tell you what to do. And that's a fair and just society. We don't have that mentality. What we have,
right,
is, oh, I just want to live my life and be left alone. And I hope the guys that are in power don't frack everything up for me. You know,
right,
it's living a dream.
Again, it's not only a dreamlike reality, but it's a child's mentality. It's like a child trusting a parent, you know?
Oh, my God. It's so true. To believe that the state is absolutely necessary and you can't do,
sure,
without it, and that it is your life-giving blood and sunshine and water, is like believing in Santa Claus.
Right. It's a child's dreamlike world. Say, it always has been like this. It is this way now, and therefore it always needs to be like this, because this is all we've ever known. Again, returning to that theme of the shunning the unknown. You know, if you just look at this simple model, I actually laid this out a little bit last night in the presentation. If you just look at the simple model of what people want government to be in the modern day, okay, you have the so-called leftists, the Democrats here in America, maybe Labor Party in some other countries, you know, they're the quote-unquote liberals, right? And I would qualify that and say they're certainly not classical liberals. They're what people would call neoliberals, okay? To put a political terminology onto it, to latch something like that onto it. But whatever term you want to group them into, what do they see government as? What do they want government to be? They see government as the nurturer and the provider. They want government to provide for everyone equally so that everybody has everything that they need. All needs are met. And that's what they feel the role of government should be. This institution that is backed by a monopoly of violence, you know, to do violence to other people, to put things the way they say it should be, by decree, by fiat.
For, okay,
your own good. So, oh, of course, always.
And
always.
For the children. Let's not forget the children.
Sure. But that's what you would say the left wants. They want government to be this nurturer and protector, like an archetypal mother figure.
The nanny, okay, state.
So, exactly. That's what it's been called traditionally. And this so accurately reflects the psychological dynamic that is at work. This is someone with mother abandonment issues at some level or in some form. There are abandonment issues toward the feminine or mother side. And therefore, in proxy, they want the government to fulfill the role on a mass scale of nurturer and provider, which is typically the archetypal motherly role. So that's the psychological dynamic that is actually at work deep in the nested regions of the psyche, in the human subconscious mind, that is leading people to want and crave government to play that role in their lives. It's simply mommy issues. It is motherly abandonment issues at
now,
work.
2 points I want to make.
Look at the opposite real quick. Look at the opposite, the right, the political right, right? What do they want? They don't want the same thing as the political left. They don't want government to play the same role or execute the same functions, okay? They see a completely different role for government. What do they want it to be? The political right, or what you would call the conservatives or the neocons, or, here in America, it's the Republican Party, okay? In other countries, I believe it's simply called Conservative Party, okay? They want the government to act as the protector. They want it to act as the policeman of the world, to go out, or at least here in America, that's certainly the case. They want it to be a strong central government and a strong father figure. So they're craving the opposite. That by proxy, they want government to play the role of father, of the archetypal father figure that actually keeps the family safe, keeps the family dynamic safe, and goes out and looks for danger and polices the environment, polices the world, if you will. And that is someone with psychological abandonment issues toward the fatherly side, someone with daddy issues, I would say. Mm. All you have to do is just look at the two basic dichotomies within the political spectrum, the false political spectrum at that, because it's all just control. It's all just slavery. But if you just look at those two seemingly polarized dynamics, you recognize they're at the core, underlying it, in the subconscious mind, it's unresolved abandonment issues that are at work.
Mm.
Parental abandonment issues.
Yeah, I see that a lot. And in fact, to talk about Zeitgeist and Bill Cooper, these are two things I wanted to mention before to illustrate your point, and I find that it illustrates both sides of the argument actually quite well, is that the Zeitgeist movement in New Zealand, I filmed for them like a number of years ago, filming the screenings and little meetings and what have you. And I found that the guys who I'd go home with back to their place to hang out and what have you, that they all had really wealthy parents and were unemployed. And I thought, isn't that interesting that somebody who's had everything handed to them their entire life and doesn't have to work for a living is in favor of a society where all of the work is taken care of for them and they still don't have to work for a living? And then,
right.
And then there's Bill Cooper, who talked about socialism. This is what socialism is. You're living at home with daddy. Now, he pays for your roof. He gives you your food. But if you want to go to the next town to go to a party, you have to ask daddy's permission.
Right.
If daddy tells you to do something, you have to do it. You have to do the dishes. You have to take out the garbage.
Right.
You don't
right.
actually have any freedom. You're a slave. And so what we've got here, and I think you've identified this quite well, is the false left-right paradigm, which is that kind of I want my parents to take care of me and not have to do anything myself personally,
right.
Versus I want daddy to take care of me and I don't want to be able to do things of my own volition. I want somebody to tell me what to do. I want somebody to define the parameters of my life. So not only do I not want to do anything with my life, I want somebody else to define for me what I can and can't do as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. And what does that ultimately do? It absolves you of your personal responsibility to actually go out into the world, do the right thing, and make something worthwhile with your life, and then basically help to teach and propagate those ideas to other people. And therefore you're shunning personal responsibility and you're striving to remain that psychological child. So that's ultimately what this is all about. It's about nested deep down in the subconscious mind through whatever traumas may have put it there, unresolved parental abandonment issues. And that's what the presentation last night, I led with this notion that what we're really dealing with at the core level is unresolved abandonment issues. And there's a larger framework of abandonment that has happened in the ancient past that may have dealt with who our quote-unquote cosmic parents were as a species. And that's what I then got deeply into as part of the presentation, which, like I said, I'll just offer that as a teaser, and people can check out the video in their own time once it goes up. But you know, people will hear this and they'll say, well, you know, many people can't accept that neither one of these sides is true. You know, if you're not for socialism, oh, then you must be for fascism. If you don't support the conservative agenda, then you must be a neoliberal. When I tell people I don't believe in money at all, I think the monetary system is a fake religion that has been given to us as a mechanism of control. They say socialist, communist. I'm neither of those things. I think socialism and communism are among the greatest evils in the world. Okay. And nor am I a rampant capitalist that believes in money and the so-called anarcho-capitalist system. You know, I think all monetary systems need to abolish. I am for the expansion of consciousness to a level where people recognize that we are one. Now, again, that doesn't mean worldwide communism either. Okay. So think about this, right? If you truly recognize that you're a family, let's say a real, actual, like nuclear-style family, a mother, a father, and two children, right? Let's say you place them out in the wilderness, right? Would they develop a monetary system among themselves?
No.
Would that make sense?
Not if they were on their own. I mean, monetarism has only really become much of a threat since its inception of being able to print out more money than you've actually got, you know, the gold hoarders, right, and all of that kind of stuff, just printing out paper receipts and golds that they just didn't have. And that's the inherent evil within. That's the inherent
it's
evil.
It's become rampantly evil since that.
And that's how they manage to use. It's kind of like money to me is a representation of energy. Now, the thing is, I have to sweat. I have to work. I have to dig a shovel in a ground for several hours in order to get this much note representation of energy.
Right.
It's not fair or just or moral for somebody to click a few keyboard buttons and have this much energy for themselves.
Sure. And nor is it fair for somebody to say, I'm going to impose taxation and say, you did this amount of labor, I'm going to take this and redistribute it where I see fit to redistribute it, because I think that's the right thing to do. Both of these concepts are inherently wrong. In addition to that, rampant greed would also be inherently immoral, and saying, I'm just going to acquire as much as I can without any looking at anybody else, what they may need or how they may be suffering, and I'm just going to just hoard all of this just for myself and whoever else be damned. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these aspects are wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, people from different aspects of the political spectrum hear things that I'm saying, and they all get offended, you know? It's offending people on all sides of the equation.
In fact, that's what I've been saying for years, Mark, is that I offend both sides of every major argument.
Right.
You know why?
Sure.
Because the reason why those both major arguments have been going on for so long is because both of them are wrong, and they hate me because I'm right.
That's right. There's a truth that isn't involved in that dichotomy and that internal opposition that's going on there between those two limited sides of that debate. There's another aspect to it that is actually the truth of the matter. So the truth of the matter is we are that family in the wilderness. That's the truth of the matter. Mm-hmm. Now, would the mother look at the father doing some physical labor and say, I'm going to take that just for me, and you must continue to do this, and I'm going to take as much as I can, and I'll let you know how much you may keep. The mother probably would never do anything like that if she really truly cares about the husband and her children. They would work together, and they would see themselves as one. They would not see themselves as separate. Would the father who just did some work to grow some vegetables say to the daughter who he's trying to help support and help to live and thrive and survive and grow and have a quality of life, you're going to have to give me something in return for your meal today? No. He would do the work that would be required, and it would be shared amongst the family. So would the children get involved in when they could doing that work that would be necessary for their survival. Mm. It would be a cooperative effort. Now, people hear commune in this. I'm not advocating communism. I'm saying that cooperation that is voluntary and done because people see the inherent oneness in all beings. That's the level of consciousness that we need to get to. When we do that, we can develop a gift economy that would not require exchange of imaginary notes or credits or any kind of, you know, what they call a chitless society, any kind of chit or little representation of wealth. You know, people insist that the idea of money in general is an exchange system. And I also reject that. And that seems like a foreign concept to many people too, that, well, you're saying money's not an exchange system. Yes, I'm saying money is not an exchange system. It is not even there, is not even designed to be there to ameliorate exchange of goods and services. Sure.
Money is kind of like, when people say it's an exchange system, that means that money is a funnel. You pour something in one end and it gets concentrated down here and you can keep it and take it away kind of thing, you know, storable wealth of some kind. But it's not like that. It's actually more like one of those little things that you've got inset into your sink that you pour stuff into it and it grinds it up and turns it into mush. That's what money system actually does.
Pretty much.
It destroys and compacts society down until right. There's nothing left, until everything that was once owned collectively by people that they shared anyway and took care of just because they could and just because they should, hey, that doesn't frickin' exist anymore. It's all in a few hands who destroy it.
Because what gets brought into a system where there is a differential put in place like a monetary system, and you have haves and have-nots, and you have those who prosper and do really well and those who are poor and do more poorly in it, is ego. Ego is the dynamic that gets brought into that. It's saying, always saying, what's in this for me? Okay, now I'm not going to try to tell you that there would be no selfishness with, you know, or just possibly even just outright laziness in a system, especially in a transitory system that was abandoning a monetary system. Of course, you are going to have issues and problems like that and some level of chaos like that in moving from a hierarchically organized and completely a differential organized system like a monetary system to something like a gift economy. Mm. What I'm trying to get at is, what is the underlying consciousness shift that would be required to do away with a control system called money? See, that's what people don't understand. They look at it as an ameliorating exchange system instead of a control of energy system. See, people look at money and they call it currency. One of the reasons I feel that it was deliberately named currency is to equate it with word magic, psychologically, with the idea of current, which is the flow in a system, whether it be water or electricity or otherwise. Okay? Current is the flow inside of a system, the rate of flow. Now, when you look at money as the current in the system, I feel that's the exact wrong model to look at it as. Okay? What it is the resistance in the system. If we're talking about DC current here, or you could call it the impedance in a system if we're talking about AC electricity, okay? So that's what it really does. It impedes the flow, the natural flow, okay, by putting reducing the consciousness to ego identification and what do I have to get out of this exchange? How do I have to profit from this exchange? And I understand the concept of adding value. I get that, you know, if you bake bread, you took, you know, grains and, you know, added value to that and made something that didn't exist in that form before, and therefore you added value by doing that work. I get that. What I'm trying to explain is the level of consciousness that we need to get away from this control system is to understand money is not the currency in the system, the current in the system. It is the limitation in the flow of energy that prevents goods and services from flowing to people if it is not present. Okay? So by making that present, you're putting an impedance in the system. Naturally, if the consciousness that would be there without that monetary system would allow those goods and services to flow naturally, and there would be no impedance in that system if we were to be able to come up to that level of consciousness. Most people who cannot imagine a monetary system not existing are at too low of a level of consciousness to even conceive of how that can work. And what I call that is perfect mind control. I call that the perfected form of mind control, because the greatest form of mind control is one where you have controlled the thinking of the being to such an extent that they cannot even imagine that it could be any other way. It is what I have called the death of the imagination. The only way that we could ever create something that is better than what we have now is to first imagine that it can be better and it can be a different way. If you are so mind controlled through indoctrination and repetition and hardened attachment to a belief system, okay, to an institutionalized belief system and a religion, which is what money is, the imagination is completely stifled and choked, and you cannot even imagine in your mind, okay, mentally, that it could possibly not exist and people could be okay as a result, even with this system gone. And admittedly, I would say that can only work if consciousness evolves to a point where we see ourselves as that family out in the wilderness with all the same basic drives and desires and requirements and needs, and we get the ego out of the way and say we are of one nature, we are of one fundamental unity and oneness at a unified level, at a spiritual level, and we are going to treat each other as such. You know, would you deprive someone of a family member, a very close family member, like a child, of food if they couldn't pay you for it as their parent? Or would you, as someone else's sister or brother or nephew or aunt or, you know, whoever, would you say, I'm going to deprive you of food or resources or shelter or something because you can't give me something in exchange for it?
I call that dynamic where everybody's giving everybody just a little of something and not expecting anything back, yet getting it back in some way, some forth, the perpetual reciprocal mooch phenomenon. All right?
Right. So what have you just described, Vinny? You've described current in a system. That's what that is. It's a flow, a free flow of energy without impedance. You just described it in a nutshell brilliantly.
Yeah. And I do consider myself to be rather the master of being a perpetual mooch. I mean, think about it. I have not had a day slave job in
Non-stop. Like
6 years. And I have not gone without food, not gone without water, not gone without shelter, not gone without internet, not gone without gas. Okay, it all
when
comes
you step
to me
into
somehow.
The truth, when you step into the truth, the universe provides. I like how Jack Blood describes it: "Be bold, and mighty forces
this
will come
to
your
aid."
Yeah. You know, if you're standing in the truth, that impedance is going to drop away, and there's going to be free flow in the system. I absolutely know that that's the case, and you do this nonstop. You know, I look at it like, hey, I put out podcasts infrequently. I used to do a weekly radio show. I don't know how guys like you do it. You know, and people like you, people like Bob Tuscan, people like even Alex Jones. I mean, to do this every day, it's unbelievable. Like, I look at you guys as almost superhuman. Like, it's like if I did what I do every single day without any stopping and break, like even a 5-day-a-week thing, I would be, I don't know how you do it. I would be so burnt out. It would be unbelievable. But like you said, as long as you're continuously giving and providing freely, that system is going to open up and it's going to provide energy to you. It's kind of like how I feel at a presentation or when I'm really locked into the zone giving a podcast or something. While you may feel somewhat physically drained and it's like an effort to continue on, you're also feeling an energy upwelling, and you get like this rush because you're doing what really needs to be done. See, I described it. We went to a restaurant in the area after the presentation I gave last night, and I was talking to some people about this dynamic, and they were saying, how do you continue on, even, or maybe even like, you know, don't you ever get depressed thinking, oh, the world's really messed up, and knowing what you know, I don't know how you continue to do what you do, even though, you know, a lot of people are still completely asleep and haven't even begun this quest or this journey into truth. And I tried to explain it like how I see this is, I'm not controlled by the will of Mark Passio. Okay, the individuated being, like the image, the visage that you're seeing here on the screen. That's not the will that controls me, okay? Or that's not the will that I'm directed by. I'm directed by what I would call the capital W will. What I want, what Mark wants, okay, is that lowercase W will, that little W will, okay? That's not what directs the work that I do, or where I am summoning or pulling the energy from with what I need to do in the world. A higher will is directing that purpose and that flow of energy. I simply try to get my ego to stand out of the way and step into the slipstream of that will, and then, you know, the energy is provided. Mm-hmm. So that's how I look at it. I look at it as we have to step into that slipstream of the higher will, what has been called will with a capital W, or the will of creation, or some people have simply called it the will of God, and I have no problem with that term either. Mm-hmm. I think that's where that infinite energy really comes from, ultimately.
Yeah, and coffee. Now, if I could explain, this is how I do everything. I create shortcuts and cut out things that are unnecessary. All right? That's the only reason why I'm able to do 5-day-a-week radio show with 5 archived radio shows, 5 archived videos that are edited with 2 camera angles and everything like that every single day. It's the reason why I'm able to cut together a slideshow documentary in a night, is because I cut out the bullshit. All right?
Right.
And this is precisely what you're famous for. can you see it there? It's Passio, right? It wipes out that bullshit, man.
That's right.
Yeah.
Purification. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it really is that apophatic process of taking away what's unrequired, what's not required. You know, again, going back to solutions, when people ask me, what's the first thing I should be doing? What can I do if I don't know about any of this and I'm just starting out? I tell people, get on to purifying the body, you know, because you have to get the physical toxins out. You know, I look at juicing as a great way of doing that. And you think about what that's doing. It's breaking down the nutrient density in the food to get that into the cells. And that acts as a cleansing mechanism. You know, different kinds of juices act as cleanses to the body because you're putting distilled water, and that carries away a lot of inorganic impurities in the body. You know, and we have to do the same thing with our mind. You know, I love the example that the researcher Michael Tesarion, again, always gives about sanity, you know, in regard to sanitation, cleaning the mind, cleaning the psyche. You know, we would not dream of taking a dinner plate, putting food on it, eating dinner, leaving the scraps and remnants and the detritus of whatever meal we had just eaten, okay, leaving that on the plate to cake up night after night after night, and putting more food on the plate and eating from that same dirty plate night after night after night. Wow. No one would dream of doing that.
That's
you know,
gross.
We would go get a new plate at the very least, or we would clean that plate and put food on a clean plate. We're not doing that psychological cleansing. We're not doing that emotional cleansing. And we think that that's going to lead to something that is palatable or healthy. It can't lead to anything that's going to be palatable and healthy. It can only lead to disease. It can only lead to discomfort. It can only lead to breakdown and decay and chaos. So that will that we have to summon to do that work on ourselves to purify in all these different ways has to be slowly built up, like a person who is coming out of a situation where their muscles are atrophied, and they'd have to start with some small weights, do things in a small stepwise progression, and eventually build up to the big weights.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It is a good way to take it slowly and take it gently, and kind of like I had a realization the other day, Mark. I want to share this with you. I realized that the knowledge that I possess, a lot of people think that I'm older than I am. I'm only 28. Because I've accumulated such knowledge firsthand from researchers like yourself and many others, because I interview like 5 different people a week, give or take.
Of course.
And so what dawned on me is that I haven't actually earned any of this knowledge. I haven't actually deeply researched into it to read all those books and do all of that really, you know, hard, what I consider the real work, right? I'm just a douchebag with a microphone helping people who do the real work, like the real research and what have you, get their words and messages and knowledge out there for people who were previously completely unaware of them. Not because that one interview that I do with said person in and of itself is enough, but because a listener might hear that one interview and go, wow, that person had something there. Do they have more content? Yes, they do. Hey, here's the website link on the VinnieEastonShow.com. And then they can go and start researching into that, because I think there's 2 types of people in the world. You know, everybody says, oh, there's 2 types of people, and there's millions of different examples about what those 2 types of people are.
Sure.
But in my case, there are generalists, multidisciplinaries kind of thing, and then there are specialists. Right.
Right.
Specialists are incredibly useful at particular items, particularly research, certain skills such as, I don't know, engineering and what have you. You'll have these individual specialists who are just geniuses at doing these one really complicated, really difficult thing that nobody else can do. Generalists, on the other hand, they'll know about those particular things that nobody else can do except that guy. Kind of instead of being a jack of all trades, they're a jack of all aces, you know? Like, you know a little bit about a lot of knowledge, so that if something comes up in a conversation or comes up on a work site or something of that nature, you're capable of filtering through multiple spectrums of information in order to look at it holistically and find the best possible solution. Even if you don't actually possess the actual skills and actual knowledge to get it implemented, you can still point people in the right direction.
Absolutely. And I think that's very important for people to become generalists. The term in different, you know, maybe occult schools of thought, or just, you know, the how academia or intelligentsia might look at this is a polymath. That's the term that they will generally use for this. Someone that has a lot of knowledge about many different areas or topics of knowledge. And that's what really we need to strive to become, I feel, are polymaths. We need to be generalists. And that's not to say specialization, as you pointed out, is not important, because it is absolutely important. But we can't, in other words, we can't lose sight of the forest for the trees. When we focus in with laser-like precision, you can't lose sight of the big picture. So it's okay to be a specialist on a particular topic or issue or, you know, school of thought or, you know, a skill set or whatever. But everybody in their own way should be a generalist as well, and be able to understand how the big pattern, the tapestry fits together, because this is ultimately about pattern recognition. That's what consciousness really ultimately is. It's about being able to recognize patterns, not only what's going on within us in our own internal makeup, but of course to recognize the patterns that are taking place around us in our environment. That's what consciousness ultimately is all about.
Now, I think we should probably take another break or wrap up the show, because I'd be willing to talk for another hour if you want to take a break and then come back.
I think this is a good place to wrap it up if you want to do that. And we could just put people onto my site and they can go there for, again, as you said, you point them in that direction. They can go there for further research. And on my site, I do that all the time as well. I try to point out people that I felt have helped me tremendously in my awakening process and in the knowledge that I have accrued. And, you know, there's that old saying, if I have seen further, it is because I have stood upon the shoulders of giants. You know, these other researchers in these fields, in these alternative research fields, they've done this work to an extent. And, you know, nature builds on top of pre-existing systems in many cases. It uses what is already there. And, you know, the concept that everything has to be brand new and, you know, nobody's going to just take something and aggregate it. You know, I tell people you're not going to see things that are brand new here. I might have some insights that some people may not have said in the same way, but this is just all here. It's always all been here. The truth has always been here among us. It's our job to recognize it and then learn it, take it in, and then speak it to other people so that they may also recognize it. So, you know, the concept that there is nothing new under the sun, that is a saying that comes out of a lot of mystery school traditions, is something that highly resonates with me. And I always have to kind of chuckle at people who say, oh, there's nothing new here in what this person is saying, and he's just rehashing some things or conglomerating or aggregating information. I take that almost as a badge of honor. That's what I do. I am aggregating information. Yeah. And I think that's a great skill set to have.
Yeah.
I'm an aggregator of information. When you do that effectively for people in a way that is logically organized, okay, and helps people to make sense of information, they're suddenly able to see a tapestry and a pattern that they may not have been able to see before. So I take that actually as a badge of honor and a compliment when people say that. There is nothing new under the sun, ladies and gentlemen. It has always been here. It is up to us to recognize and see the pattern and then share that with others. So I'd like to just say that first, and then I'll just give my website so people can go do some further research on their own, and they could also see some of the people who I share information from and check out their research as well. And a lot of those links and documents are on my website also. So you could go to my website, whatonearthishappening.com. And I highly recommend people. The videos are great to check out. A lot of people like to start there. My personal recommendation is the audio is the real core, the bulk of the material. I suggest going to the podcast section and, of course, working your way through progressively in order at your own pace without skipping around from number one forward through to the most recent ones. So the website once again is whatonearthishappening.com. And Vinny, I want to just thank you for once again for this great opportunity to come on your show and share this information with people.
It's vice versa. Now, you know that John F. Kennedy quote that I sent you?
Yes.
Would you like...
Excellent soundbite, by the way.
I think that this would be a good time to actually play that to close up the show so that the listeners can hear it. And when I first heard this quote last night, I'd never heard this speech from John F. Kennedy. And it was in a Justice League cartoon, of all things. And I actually wept because it occurred to me how great these words are, how we can cast spells with vowels and consonants, how we can inspire men to be more than they are just through our words. And we have those people killed because they threatened the dominance of the slavery system. That was what really upset me.
But for every individual that they'll take down in that fashion, and now it's becoming increasingly dangerous to their agenda what they want to accomplish to do that in any form of an open way, okay? For every warrior like that that gets taken down that was waking up and trying to share some truth with other people, I feel that 100 or 1,000 will rise in their place. There's not going to be any stopping this progression. I think it's just going to be a matter of, you know, how much suffering is going to be required if people continue to hold on and cling to these outmoded and outdated systems that don't serve us anymore. But I think it's ultimately inevitable, and they know it, and that's why they're ultimately clamoring to try to maintain control. And that really means that they're running scared in the long run, because you know, the truth is not going to be held down forever, and there are people who are going to come forward in a dedicated way to speak it without apology, okay? Speak it unapologetically and put it out there for people without fear. And that's ultimately what it's all about, and that's what enables people to, again, see the big picture, see the pattern, and then hopefully get involved in that dynamic and get involved on that spiritual battlefield to take that information out to other people in as open and as free of a way as possible.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, let's just open up this wee audio track here, this quote from John Fitzgerald Kennedy. May God rest his soul.
pioneers gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build our new West. They were determined to make the new world strong and free, an example to the world. Some would say that those struggles are all over, that all the horizons have been explored, that all the battles have been won, that there is no longer an American frontier. And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. Beyond that frontier are uncharted areas of science and space, unsolved problems of peace and war, unconquered province of ignorance and prejudice. I'm asking each of you to be pioneers towards that new frontier. My call is to the young in heart, regardless of age. Can we carry through in an age where we will witness not only new breakthroughs in weapons of destruction, but also a race for mastery of the sky and the rain, the ocean and the tides, the far side of space, and the inside of men's minds? All mankind waits upon our decision. A whole world looks to see what we shall do. And we cannot fail that trust, and we cannot fail to try.
That's right. We can't fail to try. You know, no matter how hopeless the situation, there's still inspiration out there. So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed this little episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I know I certainly have. I was like, on our break in the midway through the show, Mark, I was like just making myself a coffee going, fuck yeah, I'm interviewing Mark fucking Passio. You know, and it's not like some kind of idol sort of BS. It's more like, thank Frank, I have the opportunity to talk to such great men from all around the world every day for a living. And I made that happen. I organized it, I recorded it, and I'm putting it out there for people. And I'm inherently excited about my existence in and of itself.
And in turn, Vinny, thank God we have people like you. Thanks so much for what you do.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening, and you can check out all the archives, and please donate, because this is a listener-supported show, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, because this Christmas, we need the money for presents and stuff. See you again sometime, folks. In the summer, in the city, when the girls are so pretty, the sweatshirts down my brow, the sun nervous by their smiles. In the summer, with the scars, they got me under a spell. Ooh. 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 Ooh.